Tad vidi pranipatena paripasnena sevya upadekshani te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshina. Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, is explaining the process of taking shelter of a spiritual master in the disciplic succession. It is said one must inquire, one must render service in a submissive mood. The spiritual master then will reveal transcendental knowledge because he has seen the truth. The truth begins with Krishna. It is Krishna who reveals to us really what the truth is. No living being on his own can just figure it out. Even so many great philosophers, some of them had brilliant ideas and they got a little piece of the puzzle, but they never got the full picture. Because by nature, the living being is small. It is said Anu, atomic in size. And Krishna is unlimited, and so is his creation. So the entire world is sometimes described like the Bhava Sagar, or the ocean of material existence. England, after all, is an island, and I'm from the Netherlands, also on the coast, so we live with the sea. We are sea-going nations. The sea is kind of close to us, and it is a fact that once you are at sea and you come to a point as you are going away from the shore, there's no more land. Water in all directions, only water and waves. Material existence is compared to that. It's compared to, we can't really oversee. We can't oversee everything around us. We just see a little bit of everything that is there, and therefore we can never get full control on the material circumstances. There are too many factors that are not under our control. Just as on a ship, you may control everything on deck, but that doesn't mean you can control the weather, right, or the waves. They have a life of their own. So, in this way, Prabhupada says, whenever we are at sea, that even when the weather is very nice, even when everything is very peaceful, still it's always a precarious situation. And we will only be really safe when we're back on shore. So Prabhupada said, in the same way, in the material world, no matter how nice everything looks, we are in a precarious situation. Padam padam yadvipadam natesha. Yesterday, someone young said to me, I know about Krishna consciousness, but Maya is so strong, and I just want to enjoy. I understand, So do I. But does it work? Yeah. It's going really fine. Well, for how long? Material energy has two sides to it, happiness and distress. And that is just inevitably so. And that will never change, no matter what we do. It's just like when I was a new devotee, I saw all this mahaprasadam and all these cakes and all the sweets, and I always was thinking, if only I could have all those things. Now, I am And now I can have all those things, right? I can have unlimited cakes and unlimited sweets, but I can't eat them. Because now I'm getting too old for these things. So it's like that, the material world. There's always limitations. Talking about birthdays, you know, I used to, every birthday, write my list of most desired presents, right? And I would describe it in full detail, including the serial numbers and so on. And then, you know, and then my father, he would buy the same brand, but one edition cheaper, you know. Oh, God, what a bummer, you know. My childhood traumas are still with me. And then, you know, but thinking about that, it is kind of a symbol of material life. Because in material life, the dream is this big, and reality is, well, you know, you just gotta take it as it comes. You gotta accept. You get a little less than the dream. Otherwise, life would be a fairy tale, and it's not. But the spiritual world is just the opposite. We see in the story of Dhruva Maharaj, we see how Dhruva Maharaj wanted a kingdom greater than his father and grandfather, and he got something in the end which by far exceeded his dreams. It was more than he could have imagined. So that is the nature of devotional service, that Krishna gives us more than we could ever imagine, than we could ever dream. So that's the spiritual reality, just the opposite of the material reality. So, my father used to say, son, life is a compromise. I didn't like that. And I told him, I said, maybe for you, but not for me. Now he's late. But I would maybe still say the same thing today. Maybe for you, but not for me. Because devotional service is not a path of compromise. The path of devotional service is a path of going for full happiness. Not for like, well, you know, we settle. We settle for a little less, we're happy with what we got. We can't complain. Yeah. We can't complain. Yeah, kind of thing. That's not devotional service. We can't complain, but we feel like complaining. But we can't. That's doesn't exist. Devotional service, the result of it is always increasing. And the inspiration and happiness is reaching greater and greater levels. Initiation is an important moment. It is a moment where we formally say to Krishna, Krishna, I'm yours. My life belongs to you. And with that, everything we have, or everything, everyone connected to us also. Like, I'm very happy that, you know, the family has come, because in a way it's true that if, when a husband gets initiated or your father gets initiated, you also get initiated a little bit, right? You may not fully get initiated, but you get initiated a little bit in a sense that it also becomes part of your life as much as of his. Or if your mother gets initiated, same thing. Then you also get a little bit initiated. So therefore, the family members, they can also all later on, during the sacrifice, throw grains in the fire. And that's very auspicious, because in that throwing of the grains, we are burning up karma. Karma is such a thing. Karma, or the reactions to our previous activities, is what causes us different types of problems or whatever in this life. So throwing some grains is a very auspicious thing. It will lift us up. So I would be very happy if all the family members partake. That would be nice. And yes, the idea of an initiation is it's a very auspicious moment. I saw a ceremony with where many devotees were initiated and many spiritual masters were all speaking, and one after the other, the spiritual master spoke, and they all stressed the seriousness of the occasion. And so, Utkar, a little serious. And then Indrajumna Maharaj, who has a light touch, he spoke. And he said, you know, initiation is a very important moment. He said, you know, when... hey, chup, chup, chup. Hey, it's gonna... if it... yeah, you try a little longer. It's all right. I don't want you to leave. But if it really gets stereo or quadraphonic, then you gotta turn the volume down. Yeah. So Indrajumna Maharaj was explaining how the living being, the jiva, falls from the spiritual world, and as the jiva falls, it's a downward course, he said. But then when you come in touch with the devotees, then that downward direction gradually shifts, right, and begins to turn. And then, you know, it gradually comes to a horizontal point, and at the point of initiation, you start to go up, back up, right? And the course then of our journey forms the... exactly the pattern of a smile.
Well, that was nice.
He lightened up the atmosphere with that. And it is a fact. So it's a joyous occasion. It is a very blissful time. It is after many, many lives now, the road to auspiciousness is open. Using the analogy of the ocean, it was here in the UK that I received the order of sannyas in the Bhaktivedanta Manor in 1997, and at that time Pajumna and Aniruddha also received initiation. And well, it was, I had come by boat, and I was going back by boat. So I was on the North Sea, and it was May, it was nice weather. I was sitting on the deck with my new danda, right, thinking about my new vows. And a verse from the Bhagavad Gita came to my mind. And the verse is apuryamanam achala pratistam apasamudra pravisanti atvat tatvat tamaya pravisanti sarve sasanti anutina kam kami. It is said that just as the rivers flow into the ocean, the water of those rivers is not affecting the ocean. Because the ocean is so full with water, what is the little water of a few rivers gonna do to it? Yeah, so much water, no effect. So Prabhupada, or Krishna, then explains that in the same way, if the heart is full of service to Krishna, full of desires to please Krishna, then there is no space for all kinds of material desires to settle in that heart. But if the heart is very empty, There's no service to Krishna, nothing. We have no concern with Krishna. Then the heart is always empty. And then all kinds of desires, they just find space in that heart. So this is a very important point, a very important meditation. It is the key to success in living with these vows. When the heart is empty, or when there is not, when we are not absorbed in service, Prabhupada said, an idle mind is the devil's workshop. Kamani kanchini. He said, and the devil then means illicit sex and money. Right? That's sooner or later, it will drift towards that. Yes. So in this way, apuryamanamachalapatistam, by being fully engaged in service to Krishna. So as I was sitting on the deck of the ship, it was plying over the unusually calm North Sea, and I was thinking, yes, today the waves are not so rough, but, you know, I know that North Sea, and it can be different. It can show another face. So, the three modes of material nature, they may sometimes be very pleasant and very peaceful, and other times they may create turmoil and storms and name it, right? Just like the North Sea. But, all right, we stay on that ship, on that boat of transcendental knowledge very carefully. Vista Jnana Plavena, which is this boat of transcendental knowledge, is going across the ocean of material existence. We remain absorbed in service to Krishna. So I'm happy to hear that when devotees take responsibility in service, because I know that that will be their saving grace. Our first service is chanting Hare Krishna. But how much Hare Krishna can we chant? Right? How long can we chant? And even if we chant many rounds, how attentive can we chant many rounds? And even if we can chant rounds attentive, with how much love can we chant rounds? I remember that once on one Gaur Purnima, I chanted 64 rounds, and I just finished my 64 rounds, and I walked through the reception of the guest house, and there was a newspaper lying on the table, and my mind wanted to go there, you know, pick up that newspaper, and I go, this is ridiculous, you know. I've just chanted 64 rounds, and now my mind wants to read a newspaper, just to relax, you know, after so much concentration. It's the nature of the mind, you know? The mind. So our minds, our minds may not be completely purified. It may take time to purify our minds. Our minds may be drawn to the material world. In the Nectar of Devotion, there is a description about Uddhava. And it is said that once Uddhava saw a beautiful young girl, and his mind became attracted to this young girl. So Uddhava said to himself, what is this? What's happening? My mind attracted to a girl? Says, how is it possible? My mind is attracted to this girl as much as it normally is attracted to Krishna. I think it must be Krishna dressed up like a girl. And it was. So that's very Krishna conscious, right? That's very advanced. So Uddhava was a very exalted, advanced personality. But we might not be quite there, right? Our minds may not have that level of attachment to Krishna. Our hearts may not yet be filled that much. So, we are looking for purification of our consciousness. And it's not, in this purification, there are two aspects. It is said that initiation is part of the process of devotional service. It begins with Ados Radha, first some initial faith, then Sadhu Sangha, we begin to associate with the devotees. Right? And then Bhajana Kriya. Bhajana Kriya is the regulated process of devotional service. So it is said that initiation is part of Bhajana Kriya. So this Bhajana Kriya is further subdivided into, and one is called Nitya Kriya, the other one is called Naimitiki Kriya. Nitya means that Kriya is what we do every day. So there must be a certain type of practice that depends on being regular. To be regular is a very important key in spiritual life, in anything. And if you're regular in something, then you become strong at it. You know, if you just do it like, I'm going to do it, and you work yourself a bit of frenzy, you know, I will not eat any butter anymore. Then, you know, that's the 1st of January, right? And, you know, but if it sort of becomes like a regular feature, part of regular life, and after a while, it's okay, you know, it goes. So, like this, being regular, Nitya Kriya, regular in our chanting. When we live in the temple, it is quite nice because everything centers around the deities, and it's Mangal Aarti at 4:30 every day. And that forces you to be extremely regular. And then you go through the morning program, and in most temples, it sort of finishes at 5:10, right? Tulsi Puja is over, 5:10, if the morning announcements are not too long, you know what that is. Right? And then, okay, then you start your japa, right? And then every day, we start at the same time, and you just go through the, and you, it's like, you know, by 5:30, so many rounds, by 6, so many rounds, by 6:30, so many rounds. And every day, we're in the same groove, so to speak. And it helps us to chant. And then just being in that regular groove helps us to concentrate and helps us to go deeper. So, of course, at home, you know, it's like the flexible time. Some days a little earlier, some days a bit later. And, you know. But the principle of the early morning, right, is essential to spiritual life. It's not, I know you have morning people and evening people, right? And it's true, I'm definitely in the morning category. It's like, you know, even in the old days, going through the whole night was not my my favorite. And others may be, you know, as it gets dark, they get more energy. But whatever may be, the morning hours are considered special. The Vedic time is measured in muhurtas, hours that last 48 minutes, and each of them have a particular nature. And 1.5 hours before sunrise is the Brahma Muhurta, which is particularly in the mode of goodness. That is a recommended time for spiritual practices. So the morning is important and helpful. So in this talk, I'm bringing out these things just to sort of give some good support. You know, it's all recorded, and then later on you can sort of listen to it again. And I'm trying to give some advice. Vows, right? Vows are promises where we are fixing ourselves to act according to a certain standard of behavior, which is above of what we would do naturally. If we would just let ourselves go, we wouldn't be on that level. So therefore, in taking a vow, we have to sometimes fight an inner fight. And that's comes automatically by taking a vow, because it puts us on a higher platform than we would act upon spontaneously. There is a certain amount of pressure in taking vows, or a certain amount of weight in taking vows. And the thing is, this weight of the vows cannot be taken just by determination. Like, it cannot just be done from, like, I shall do it. I'm gonna do it. I must do it. Grit the teeth and just hold on. Because time is a factor. Just like if you have to carry bags of 10 kilos, it's 10 kilos, most of us can manage, and lift it. That's all right. But 100 bags of 10 kilos becomes already quite something. I don't know if I want to lift 100 bags of 10 kilos. My bag. So the point is, with time, if it's just determination and the weight of the vows, with time becomes heavier. So that won't work. That will not do. Therefore, what is required is there must be some cultivation. So the regular practice of worshipping Krishna, if there's not a regular worship of Krishna, then spiritual life will be dry, we'll function on determination only, and our hearts will not be filled with higher taste, and it will become heavy, and the vows will become hard. And one day, it sometimes happens that, a devotee has a moment of confusion. I visited one particular temple, which was on the coast, and the temple president wasn't there. And I said, oh, where is he? They said, oh, he's gone to the beach. I said, oh. They said, 3 days ago. And he didn't come back. I go, oh, really? They said, yes. He is just sitting in front of the ocean. Well, me always looking for an excuse to go to the beach, said, let's go. So we went. And yes, they let me out of the car, and I saw him sitting there, and I sort of walked up to him and sat down next to him and didn't say anything because he was silently looking at the ocean. After about 15 minutes, I said to him, lovely view, isn't it? Anyway, from that, a lot of conversation developed, and at one point he came out with it. And he said he got struck by the question, the one question. The question was, who am I really? And that brought him to the beach. So there may be, maybe all of us have our beach, right? Our internal beach, our moment of identity crisis. So how can a devotee avoid such an identity crisis? When spiritual life becomes a life of external codes of behavior, and when you come into the temple, you're bowing down to the ground and with the tip of your nose on the ground, and so on. Endless injunctions, rules, don't eat with the wrong hand, the right hand. So many rules, right? And so sometimes people find. I just got to reconnect with myself. Therefore, of course, an identity crisis will come when the heart remained empty, when it was not filled with service, when we did not become absorbed in service. When we cannot chant all day. We cannot just sit in front of the deity full of love all day. When Lord Chaitanya saw the deity forms of Krishna, he really saw Krishna. And he became completely overwhelmed with ecstasy. We just, you know, sort of like... pranam, pranam. Yes, it doesn't really... Our heart is not so deeply involved. But by the service, gradually, our heart becomes deeper involved. So, therefore, to remain actively involved in service is important. And of course... Service especially is the property of the devotees. It is the devotees that give us service. Just like I am somehow or other here officiating in this ceremony, not because I volunteered for the service, but because it was given to me. It was given to me by my spiritual master. So in this way, devotional service is given to us. Because, Krishna is very generous. Anyone who wants to serve him, oh yes, he's pleased. But if you really want to please Krishna, oh, then it's an art. Of course, then it's an art. There is an art of pleasing Krishna. So, today we are initiated in the art of pleasing Krishna. And that art is, as I said, the devotees are the caretakers of that art. And they give us engagements. So this requires humility and tolerance, because it means that we have to tolerate the devotees. You know, oftentimes you find descriptions that one of the very important factors in spiritual life is the association of devotees. So maybe we think that with that association of devotees, that what is meant, that's where we should get our inspiration from that association. And I agree, we must get our inspiration in the association of devotees, but that's not all. The other thing is, in the association of the devotees, you have to become more and more tolerant. It is like that my spiritual master likes to say, likes to remind us of one of his teachers, Mr. Bennett, who used to say, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you something that you're never going to forget in your whole life. I'm going to tell you something that you're never going to forget in your whole life. And, so I want you to listen very carefully to what I'm going to tell you now. And that is, it all comes out in the wash. So, yes, it does all come out in the wash. Right? We are going through this process, and whatever weakness is there in us, we will be confronted with it. We will be, sooner or later, and it will have to become purified. And that's what happens in this process. So, like I myself, I've sort of resolved, no matter what the devotees are going to do to me, I'm never going to leave. I'm not going. And even if they tell me, get out, I'll first, no. I'm not going. Right? No way. If they all pick up my chair, right, and throw it outside of the gate, all right, then I'll stay outside the gate and start sweeping in front of the gate or something like that until they let me back in. But I'm not going. Right? Not going anywhere. Because that would be cutting myself off from my lifeline, just as on the ship. You know, if you're on the ship, and when the weather gets rough, sometimes a wave just hits the bow of the ship, and then just smashes on the deck. And the next one. And you know, before you know it, there you go. In the water. But in storms, we have a lifeline. Right? We got this line, this rope that connects us to the ship. In case we wash overboard, then we hang there all the string. Oh, man overboard, pull him back in, right? In this way we can... So yes, our connection with the devotees is our lifeline. That's our lifeline. So we must stay. We must stay with the devotees. Where there are devotees, there will always be service, there always will be prasadam, there always will be kirtan, there will be life, there will be spiritual life. Let me think for a moment what else I really want to say to you. So far I said stay with the devotees, stay engaged in service, it fills the heart, then the vows will not become a burden, will not lead us to an identity crisis. Remain respectful to the devotees. Don't criticize them. It's not easy. But we must try. You know, there was a little book about a manager who was extraordinary. Usually managers, their business is to find fault in people. How many times do I have to tell you? You blew it again. Can anybody do anything right in this place? Kind of, huh? But this manager was different. This manager, instead of catching people doing something wrong, was trying to catch them doing something right. Wasn't easy, but anyway, you know, after he finally found someone, then he would say, oh, this is wonderful what you've just done. And when he really found something nice, he'd glorify the person for it. So when I saw that, I thought, yes, that's us. That's us. That comes from the Vaishnava culture. Whenever we see someone doing something nice, we should glorify. We should just glorify. Not artificially glorify, but glorify, recognize the good things people do. That will save us in spiritual life. Because one thing Krishna doesn't like, if you criticize his devotees. Slowly enter, yeah? The gang goes outside. So anyway, carrying on with the ocean and the boat analogy, I'm gonna put you in a little boat, you know, today, on the shore of the ocean. And we're packing it up now with some supplies, you know, and this and that. And I'm just talking and talking and talking. And it's sort of the mind is in like sleep mode. Yeah. Talk, sleep mode. And everything is sort of going on at a slow pace. And then suddenly I'm going to take your little boat and push it. Push it into the water, and there you are, all by yourself on the waves, right? With the instruction manual and everything. And hoping you'll be all right. How can you promise something for your whole life when you don't know what life will bring? You're about to promise for the whole life, but how can you when you don't know what life will bring? The only way you can do it, right, is with the help of Krishna. Because only Krishna knows what life will bring, and only Krishna has everything under control. Therefore, only with the help of Krishna can we make these vows. So again and again, we turn to Krishna. I often say, surrender is not one time. So it's not that today you're surrendering now, right? But surrender is a lifetime of surrendering again and again from moment to moment. You have to make the best of every moment. Then we'll make the best of our life. You can't just sit and say, I'm going to make the best of my life. It doesn't work like that. I'm going to make the best of my life. No. We just make the best from moment to moment, and then in the end, life will have turned out for the best. And that's how it will work. Okay, there are 10 offenses to be avoided in the chanting of the holy name. And if you know them, right, then that's good. If you don't know them, that's not good. If you don't know them, then you should learn them. Right? By doing the law, give them. Sometimes in initiation lectures, Srila Prabhupada would explain these 10 offenses. But if we do that, it becomes very long, so I will not do that now. What I will say about it, we must be respectful. Respectful to the devotees, respectful to the scriptures, respectful to the deities, respectful to the Mahamantra, right? You cannot just chant and, with a pint of beer in the other hand. That's not respectful to the name. That won't work. Purity must be there. So, in this way, we are embarking. We are getting ready for taking the vows. And then we'll complete the ceremony with a sacrifice, an Agnihotra Yajna, Homa, for the sake of invoking auspiciousness. We can see the arrangement. We see the different pots, with the coconuts around the fire. The one with the red scarf is representing Krishna or Vishnu, the Yajna Purush, the controller of sacrifice. The other pots and coconuts are representing various demigods who are the agents of Krishna, controlling universal affairs that we depend on. Right? So, in this way, their presence here today is for invoking blessings. Because I've given you good advice about what you should do. Right? I've given you some what you should pay attention to. Now I'm mentioning about blessings. We depend on blessings. So we are invoking blessings in this ceremony of these greater personalities, the Supreme Lord, greater agents in the universe. By mantra, we will invoke the blessings of the acharyas, the previous spiritual masters. We'll also invoke the blessings of all the devotees. Some of the devotees may feel, well, I can't give any blessings. Who am I to give blessings? Well, anyone can give blessings. Anyone. Why Because we've done devotional service to Krishna. And if we have credits with Krishna. And because Krishna appreciates the service. And anyone who's done some service for Krishna, he has some credits with Krishna. So if that person asks, Krishna will be inclined. Therefore, we can all ask Krishna, please, let them, please bless them. Oh, that is my humble request. That yes, and all together, we go back. Finally, the spiritual master is not only an officiating priest in the ceremony. The spiritual master is much more than that. He remains with us as a permanent guide throughout our life. And although we are making vows about regulative principles and about the number of rounds being chanted, which I'm going to ask you in a moment, which they are, there are also unspoken vows. Obedience to the spiritual master. And that's not a light thing, right? That's not a light thing. We don't speak it, but that's quite a strong thing. At the same time, the relationship between guru and disciple is not one of just master and servant, but there also is firm friendship, sudrida suridam. And that's important, that we understand that he is my friend and well-wisher. And we're doing it together. Okay? We're doing it together. So it is like that. One must carry on in his spiritual life together with the spiritual master. Confide in the spiritual master. And you have people, whenever you ask them, how are you? They, fine, everything's fine. And like 1 month later, they disappeared off the map, So that's not good. There must be friendship. We must understand, there was one disciple, Srila Prabhupada, from the very, very early days, like 1966, when Prabhupada came to New York. He was one of the first devotees. But as years went by, he was not always so strict in following everything. And some years ago, he was in Vrindavan. And it was the Disappearance Day celebration of Srila Prabhupada. And he was standing on the stage, wearing blue jeans, a black t-shirt, a tiger skin vest, and sort of punkish hair. Right? And he, one of Prabhupada's early disciples. And he said, yes, I'm here. And I know that there are some out there who would rather not see me here. He says, but I'm not going. I'm not going anywhere. He said, and the reason why I'm not going anywhere, why I will never leave, is because of three words that Prabhupada wrote to me in a letter. He said, because of these three words, I will never leave. And those three words are, your ever well-wisher. Yeah. And it is like that. The spiritual master is our ever well-wisher. That means there's nothing we can do, right? That, that can spoil that relationship. Whereas maybe something in a parental relationship is similar, like even if your son is like doing something totally outrageous, he's still your son. What are you going to do about it? It's too bad. So even when a disciple does something totally outrageous, they're still your disciple. And I must say, some of my disciples did some things that were totally outrageous. I thought that being a spiritual master was that you had to explain to people something about the Bhagavad Gita and the nectar of devotion. But it's not always like that, I found. But anyway, the reason why I'm saying that is from my side, all best wishes. I will do my best to support you as much as I can, whatever you require. And in that way, all together with the spiritual master and the devotees, in that way, these vows of initiation can be taken.